It's the root of all evil.
But nobody's just giving it away.
It's the only thing not ever priceless, by definition.
Most people spend at least half their waking hours making it, and the other half spending it.
Cash, moolah, scratch, greenbacks, bread, grip, stacks, on stacks in some cases.
Money. What, why, and how this week?
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
What are we talking about today, David?
I want to talk about money. The what, why, and how is money.
I'm going to withhold my Mr. Krabs memes for now, but go on.
Yes.
I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, I don't want Viacom coming after us for that. So.
No, they will.
They totally would. So, money. What is it good for? No, wrong word. What is money?
That's a good question. What is money?
Vaguely green paper.
Green bags?
People seem to want.
Yeah. Not always. Sometimes it looks more like that thing that you use to trade in Monopoly with pictures of some old lady on it.
We don't talk about that one.
Yeah, I don't talk about tyrants either. But let's talk about countries' money real quick before we get into it. Like, I think what most people would think about when they say money.
Yeah.
Like fiat currency.
Yes.
I guess. Since that's what we were hinting at anyway. So in the States, we have, well, it used to all be like this spearmint green color. Or variations of shades of that color, or gray almost, really.
Mm-hmm.
And now it has all kinds of copy prevention stuff on it.
Right, anti-counterfeit things.
DRM money. But
DRM. not quite.
But what's interesting is to note, I have never personally traveled outside the United States. I don't know if you have.
I have not.
Okay. But I know plenty of people who have. And one of the things that they always talk about, not being a difficulty necessarily, but you usually shouldn't, they say, take American dollars and be able to expect to spend them somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through the process when you're about to travel of converting your money to their money, their being wherever there is.
Mm-hmm.
And exchange rates are weird.
Yes.
A good example, I had a friend who was going to go on a mission trip to Nigeria, I think. It was somewhere in Africa. But he was exchanging his U.S. dollars, and he took, like, I think $1,000 with him total, which was copious. But he ended up with like millions of whatever their local currency is. And he thought it was hilarious that he could call himself a millionaire now because it costs several million of this currency to buy like normal things.
Mm-hmm.
Like buying a small kitchen appliance would cost like 4 or 5 million of whatever the currency was. And it was hilarious because the currency is denoted as such. Like they print like 1, 10, 50 million whatever unit of currency.
Yeah.
Bills, and it was interesting. But it's the same way across the globe. Like there are some currencies that are very close that, like, a good example, a lot of the YouTubers I watch, they're in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll talk about, like, I'll watch one doing a game review and he'll say, you can get this game for £50. And I can roughly equivalate that to dollars. It'll be around $50, maybe 50 to 40 to 60, depending. Pounds sterling to dollars. They're pretty close. They're pretty close.
They're not that close. Like, okay, last I checked, which was fairly recently, a pound is about $1.50. That's a pretty significant difference.
It is, but not on the volume that I'm talking about. Like, sub 50 US dollars, it's not going to be that different. Like,
no.
It, as far as the, in comparison to the amount of money I have access to, if I can afford something that's worth, if I hear this is going to cost £50, I can afford that. Like, I know that that's affordable mm-hmm. for me. You're right. The bigger it gets, the more surprising it'll be when you know, because it's a rate, right? Something that costs $100, and all of a sudden it's like, well, but it's actually 150. Like, if I thought dollars to pounds mm-hmm. is 1-to-1, I was like, well, it's £100 for this. I would expect to be able to spend $100, but $150 is like, well, there, buckaroo. Like, that's a little bit more money than I expected.
Or an even bigger jump because people are tricked by numbers so easily. 200 to 300.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big difference. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but on the scale of like, oh, this meal is £5 and it comes out to being $7.50. Okay. Whatever. If I can afford a $5 meal, I can probably afford a $7.50 meal. For me anyway.
Yeah.
So, but it's not the same thing as like Japanese yen. Is that what they use in yen? It's also one of those currencies that, like, I was looking at car prices in yen because I happen to be looking at a automotive website and my vehicle happens to be of Japanese make. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Doxed. But I was using a VPN and I accidentally got allocated to that website via Japan somehow. And I was looking at the prices because it was kind of funny to me. And it was like hundreds of thousands of yen for my particular model of car. And I was like, wow, that seems a bit excessive over there. But it's because stupid brain was 1-to-1 again, you know.
Right. But no.
But quickly realizing that, no, I can't just make the same assumptions. Like, just because, like, if I hear 100 yen, I don't know if that's a lot or a little, you know. I don't understand the value intrinsically.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty close to a 100-to-1 ratio right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I've seen photos of stuff like, you'll have stuff like a candy store or something like that, and something might say like 500 yen for this, and it's like, okay, that's $5.
Yeah. So, but money's used to buy things. That's why we have money. That's what most people use money for, to buy things. It's what you're given for work that you then use to buy things.
Yeah, it's a universal good. It's not really a good because you can't use it for anything.
You can burn it.
That's true. You could burn it as fuel. It would not be a very good fuel, but you could.
No.
Interesting anecdote. But yeah, like a universal thing that people will trade for.
Right. Which I think ultimately leads to what money really is. It's a medium of exchange.
Yes.
I think that's the generic common term, like how you would describe money or define it. It's just a medium of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But as we had already kind of alluded to, money isn't value, but it's a convenient way to assign value
mm-hmm.
in a way, in a common language. So between you and I and anyone else that happens to use US dollars frequently, which I was going to say people in the United States, but we're in a kind of a weird situation where US dollars are valued elsewhere in some circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say, you know, David, I would like to sell you this old cell phone I have. I've wiped it clean. I would like to sell it to you. It's worth $50. And that's me subjectively trying to communicate to you how I feel, like how much I will let this go for.
Yes.
To me, it's worth $50 worth, you know. If we let's just look at the absence of money instead, I would somehow have to figure out something. I'd have to communicate how much I think this old phone is worth to you in a term of something else that I want that you have. But now we're relying on both of our subjective value determinations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's worth $50 to you.
Yes.
But I might not think the same way.
But that's
I could think, man, this guy's trying to rip me off. This phone's kind of old. You know, maybe there's cracks on it or something like that. You know, I'm thinking maybe, okay, well, I'll give you $20 for it. Or I might think, wow, he doesn't know what he has there. This is a really good price.
Right. But what makes this easy is that you and I both understand what the buying power of a single dollar is.
Yes.
Like it's a convenient way for you and I to look at the market, even though no single person ever looks at the market as the market. It's always instantiated in something I want to buy. But you and I can both go, a dollar will buy me a candy bar. Is this 50 candy bars worth to me? You want to think about it that way. Some people think about money in terms of time, which is mostly because a lot of people are not salary paid their hourly wage. So is this worth, if you make $10 an hour, is this worth 5 hours of your labor?
Right, but I work 5 hours to have this, yeah.
Right. Which that's different than the just using it as a value justification for like a physical thing. Mm-hmm. But in the absence of money, that's even harder because if I can't say dollars, like how do I communicate to you what this is worth to me without using dollars? It gets a lot harder because I would have to pretty much know something that I want that I would have to trade for.
Right.
So
yeah. Like I have this phone, I'm looking to get, I don't know, this thing, like something else.
Say I have this spare phone, but I'm really needing a new computer monitor. Let's just keep it within the realm.
Okay.
Okay. So I approach you and say, you know, hey, look, I'm looking to get a monitor. And this is kind of how it obviously changes. You don't start with what you have mm-hmm. to accumulate value for something else. You have to start with what you want. So I would have to go to you and say, do you have a monitor and see if you have a monitor that I want? That's the more realistic scenario. And just say for the sake of simplifying the argument, you do. So you have a monitor that I want. I say, okay, well, could I trade you this used phone for it? And depending on how you feel about that monitor, you would then have to assess whether that's a good deal or not. And that's made harder. Because then if you say no, it's not quite enough, then I go, okay, what about this candle? Do you get what the candle and the phone, is that enough? And you go, a candle's not worth as much as a phone, but it's not even worth half. It's worth maybe a quarter of the phone to me. So that's 1 1/4 phones.
But also then it becomes subjective too. Like, yeah, I already have plenty of candles. Like I don't need this right now. Yeah.
Right. And it becomes very momentary. Because I could probably, but if I go to your neighbor's house, which in this weird world, I'm going door to door trying to buy a monitor, but say I do go to your neighbor's house and I want to, let's be realistic. I'll go to a tech vendor who's selling technology. They will more realistically look at the phone differently than you would. You're looking at it as, I'm going to have to use this thing.
Right, but they're looking at it as, I can trade this now for something else.
Right, so would I rather trade this monitor I have now, which might be harder for me to get rid of, for something that'll be easier for me to get rid of later at a higher price? You know, but I guess the point I'm trying to make is that bartering, which is what this is, we've been describing the bartering system, which was the way humans exchanged goods.
Before money.
Goods and services.
Sure.
It's hard now to think about. Maybe back then it wasn't as difficult because what were the things being traded most often?
Animals.
And food. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it was a little bit easier, but still, you're coming up with weird ratios for what's the ratio of pigs to goats?
Like, right.
You know, these, and it's all subjective, but eventually we kind of converge on a momentary understanding of which is more valuable. Even though it's always in flux, because if turns out pigs are highly desirable for some reason, well, now pigs are worth more. So I used to be able to trade 2 goats for a pig, but now it's 4 goats for a pig because no one wants goats, but everyone wants pigs. Inflation, man. Pigflation. But anyway, but yeah, and so that's the obvious problem of it's just difficult to get what you need and to get rid of what you don't need. But there's the other issue, which is how do I store value? What if I just wanted to get rid of something that I don't need right now, but I don't have anything that I want yet? So
yes.
So you go down
and this becomes especially important, like because things degrade. Most things degrade.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, I have this thing that I don't really care to have right now. I don't have anything that I particularly want right now. But the longer I hold on to this thing, the more it will degrade and the less valuable it will be by the time I do want something.
Right. And so previously, that's why things like precious metals are used as a standard a lot of the time, or have been used as standards before.
Yes.
Because they don't degrade.
They don't degrade. Yeah.
So if I somehow accumulated enough pigs to justify a sliver of gold, I would take the gold because now I can keep the gold and the gold won't degrade over time. And I could eventually accumulate enough gold to trade for something else. And gold is being used as a de facto currency in that way. But yeah, it's also...
It's money.
Yeah. It is money. Which I think that brings us down to the next question, which is what can be money?
Literally anything.
But there are a few characteristics that make some things better at being money than others.
The first one is degradation.
Degradation.
You don't want your money to degrade.
Not necessarily. Now, you can offset this. So that's the first thing. But we also talk about the fact that most money these days are made of paper, which is very degradable.
Yes.
So what's the deal with that? You know, if the first thing we want our money to be is non-degradable, then why are we using paper? I'm asking seriously. Why are we using paper then?
Because it's light. It's easy to carry. Easy to make.
Mm-hmm. Easy to make. Easy to carry. Because the joke is, you know, we used coins before, mm-hmm. which is a good halfway point. Like that was the first money was coins.
Yeah.
Because coins can be made of metals that they still degrade, but they don't degrade as fast as paper. Also, metals were more available at the time than paper because coins preceded paper.
Yes. Paper is actually quite hard to make.
Yes. But you could have said reeds or something like that, like just the reeds themselves or something instead. Or we could just make rock money. Just pebbles.
Sure.
But that leads to the next problem. It can't just be...
It has to be scarce. It
has to be scarce.
Yeah, because if you just... Yeah. Pebbles are money. Cool. Well, I have a very rocky yard, so I'm going to... Well, it's not really a yard, but a rocky place where I live, so I'm just going to get a shovel and dig up some money.
Right. But and what's kind of funny, though, is that that's kind of how it be, though.
Yes. It literally is how it is.
Only with rarer things than rocks.
Right. No one wants to buy... Well, okay. Some people do want to buy rocks, but not because they're special.
And you're not storing rocks to trade for other things.
Right.
But when you look at like European expansionism across the globe into the New World, Spain was obsessed with finding gold and silver in the New World because... It's literal money. It's money you can dig out of the ground. It's naturally occurring money that you just got to find it. Same thing with American prospectors in the Old West. People figured out there's gold in places and we can just go find it. And boom, I'm rich just by sitting. Yeah. And that's different though than like fiat currency where like there are not just bundles of dollar bills sprouting out places if you just find them, you know? So, I just to step back for a second, you know, because, well, actually, just step back. But that gets us to the point where, like, well, what about things that we manufacture that are money? They're not naturally scarce. They're artificially scarce. Or not. And I guess that goes back to the example of why currency inflation rates are the way they are. My friend who went to Africa and was trading for millions of the local currency, well, they're millions of because they... were just printed in that many. In other places, there's just fewer of them. So each you eventually reach a point where it's non-divisible. In most bill countries where you're using paper dollars only, I'm going to separate coins and dollars from paper for a moment, bills. You know, most bills go down to a single unit.
Usually.
So that's the as far down as you can go. Well, in that country, it got to the point where, well, that single bill cannot buy anything. So why bother printing it? We'll print 100 bills as the least amount because that can buy you the most smallest of things. And then eventually it got to the point where, you know, 1,000 is about as small as you can get. So we just make 1,000s now.
Yeah.
You know, but not just printed made up money, which is what we talked about so far with fiat currency. What's interesting is commodity money. I don't know if that's the term for it, but it's commodified things becoming money.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting artificial scenario is created often that makes this happen. There's two that I can think of. Schools and prison, which are really similar when you think about it, except when you get to go home at the end of the day. So in prisons... In U.S. prisons, I'll say, there are two things that are used as money. Stamps and cigarettes. not cigarettes so much anymore, but stamps are used as money. And there's an interesting reason for that.
Money is banned.
Money.
Yeah, well, the local currency is banned. Dollars are banned.
Yes. But stamps are not, because you have to be able to mail letters. But stamps can also always be redeemed at the post office for their dollar value. Did you know that?
No.
Yes. Stamps have a value printed on them. A 5 cent or a 25 cent stamp, for example. Mm-hmm. That's not just how much it costs. The post office has to redeem it for that value.
Yes.
Always. Meaning it will hold its value as long as the service.
So it literally is a note, but it is.
But it's not a currency because it's not its primary function.
Yeah.
Its primary function is to allow you to employ the postal service to do a job.
Right. It's supposed to be proof that somebody paid the postal service that amount of money in the past, and now you can redeem it to send letters and packages.
And that's why it's used for, that's one of the main reasons it's used for currency in prison outside of any other paper thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fun fact. But cigarettes for the long time have also been a currency, and that's just because of demand. You can
Here's a small thing that almost everybody in the prison wants.
Yes. And they're easily divisible. Packs of 20 can be easily broken down into single units, which can be used, and a smoke is 5 minutes, and it's a nice small enough unit where I can trade a cigarette for something as simple as, like, a good example would be like you're in the mess hall and you're eating at the cafeteria. Well, hey man, can I have your roll? You know, it's like, sure, two cigarettes, it's worth a roll, because a roll is relatively cheap, and so is two cigarettes, you know.
Sure.
But you could do packs, but it comes in divisible units, right? So you have individual cigarettes.
Yeah, cigarettes, packs, and cartons. Yep.
And that's about it. And so cartons are like $100 bills, packs are like $10 bills, and individual cigarettes are like dollars or 50 cents. Like, it doesn't exactly work out the same, but yeah, it's interesting. And this is not the first time this has happened. This happens, I guess, all the time, like I said, in schools. I don't know about you, but I remember being in school, one of the most valuable things you could have that bordered on the bartering system was candy.
Mm-hmm.
Especially post Halloween season. And while it's still close to bartering, because there's a fixed variety most of the time, the common candies were kind of used as currency. Tootsie Rolls in particular.
Yeah.
Again, because they come in different sizes. You have the standard Tootsie Roll, which is like your quarters. You have the long sticks, which are like your 50 cent pieces. And then you have the Chonko bars, which are dollars. And that's just how it was. Like, you could, you know, and of course, preference still exists. But most people like Tootsie Rolls enough that
you could use them as a
de facto currency. Yeah.
Even if Tootsie Rolls are not my favorite candy, if I get some of them, I can trade for something that I actually do want.
Right. Like, I think a common exchange rate was one long stick Tootsie Roll was like almost always equivalent to a Laffy Taffy for us.
Yeah.
Like, that was a standard accepted exchange, and a Reese's cup, like the Reese's mini cups.
But not the banana Laffy Taffy. Those are worth nothing.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a lemon. except for the one weird kid who did like them, and he just flooded the market every time. he could accumulate all the banana Laffy Taffies. But yeah, like, kids do that thing. Beyond the usual lunchroom bartering of, I'll give you my crackers for your extra PB&J snackable, you know, whatever. Like, if you want to see real human activity, go to a elementary cafeteria. You will witness civilization in a nutshell.
Yes.
In that room. It's insane. I've also heard of cap erasers. Do you remember when those first started becoming a thing?
No.
Oh, God. I'm boomering out here.
Yeah, you're old.
Well, cap erasers are colorful little triangular.
Oh, sorry. Erasers. I misunderstood what you were saying. Cap erasers. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I do.
Yeah. So those are really cheap. But they're colorful.
Yes.
And people like certain colors more. So, hierarchy established. Now we can use these as a medium of exchange. I'll trade you. He's like, I need a pencil. Well, all I got's cap erasers. I'll give you my green one for one pencil, because green is gross. And then someone's like, okay, I guess. You know. But yeah, anything can be money as long as it's ubiquitous enough. And that's, you'll notice those two things. Like after Halloween, candy is everywhere, especially the small kind of candy, which is more convenient for trading. And then in schools, things like cap erasers and pencils are plentiful. And you can use them to exchange for things, and kids do. It's quite fascinating. I distinctly remember a kid I'll stop before I go down an anecdote, because there's a better version of that anecdote. Other small ecosystems that get created, trading card games and similar collectibles games are this way.
By design.
Yes. I didn't partake in trading card games until I was an adult, and then I would just use dollars to buy what I wanted. But I did remember, I forget what they're called, but they're like these little bean things that you can flick and roll. They're pill shaped. And they have a marble. They're pill shaped with a ball bearing inside that allows them to flip end over end.
Okay, I think I know the thing you're talking about.
I don't know what they're called. I cannot remember. But those things were huge, and I had some for exchange. I didn't even play the game or collect them. I just knew that I could trade them for things. And there was some silly little game that was they were used to play with, but that wasn't the thing. I guess a better equivalent would be marbles. That's something that I think most people recognize, even though that has very subjective value to it, because marbles pretty.
Yes.
But you have to have certain amount of marbles to play a game anyway. You know, I don't know. But yeah, little toys like that are created to be traded, and that's part of the appeal, is you will amass many of ones that you don't even care about just so you can trade a lot of them for one that you want. But in order to do that, you have to buy plenty. So, boom, makes it a market, I suppose. Pokemon was also like that.
Yes.
I never played Pokemon, the card game, growing up, so I don't know at all how that worked. But
I don't think most kids did. Even when they were trading them, it was just like, look, let me show you my Pokemans.
My Pokemans.
I think almost nobody actually bothered to learn the rules of that game.
No. But just goes to show, humans, I mean, obviously money is valuable. Money is a tool. It's a tool that is useful because it creates a system that is useful. But it's totally arbitrary, and it has to just be agreed upon, which is, I think, what makes it very different than a lot of other things and interesting, because it's got physical representations everywhere, but we all use it because we all take it, but we'll all take it because we all use it. It's a chicken and egg type deal. And what it happens to be just depends on your environment. Whether it's artificial or not, like, for example, with the trading card games, that's an artificially created environment where things can be used as currency. Whereas in artificial environments like prisons, they just use different things. But in the broader society, most governments have taken it upon themselves to create currencies, even though this wasn't always the case. Currencies originated as a private thing.
Yeah.
But weren't meant for your average person, though, which was interesting.
Yeah,
initially. So much. It was made by banks.
Yes, and they, in some places, are still called banknotes. Like, that's what they were. Banknotes redeemable for something that the bank actually had.
Yes. And even today, at least in the United States, if you read a bill,
yeah,
it'll tell you who it's issued by.
Federal Reserve note.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States.
Yes.
Which that is a whole black hole we'll get into at some point. The Fed.
Not today.
But not today. But it is interesting. It is not made by the government necessarily.
Right.
It's made by a bank that
gets special authority from the government to do what it does.
Yeah. It's delegated from the government. Yeah. But previously, yeah, it was, you know, I guess the most charitable, realistic example would be that, you know, if you and I, and this also takes us back to a time when most people never traveled more than 50 miles from the place they were born. So there was the bank in the town, or a couple of banks in the town, and they would each issue their own notes. And you could use those notes to, you could give something to the bank for notes, and then those notes could be used to buy other things. Then those people could take those notes to the bank and get something for them. But usually they were backed by a precious metal if you needed to go between banks. But then other special notes were created, which were notes for banks to banks. I don't know that this is where bonds came from necessarily, but that's kind of what it was. It was a way for banks to trade value amongst themselves, not intended for general public use.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's interesting. I want to take a quick side note while we're talking about this. Do you know what a bearer bond is? I did not know what this was until the other day, but I thought it was really interesting.
Okay, so this will be a type of bond. Is this just a type of bond that could be received by whoever holds the certificate?
No, a bearer bond is a bond or debt security issued by a business entity, such as a corporation or a government, as a bearer instrument. It differs from the more common types of investment securities that are in that it is unregistered. Literally, whoever is holding it.
Okay, that's what I said.
The bond. Yeah, okay. I didn't know that.
Redeemable by whoever has the certificate.
Oh, okay. That's what you mean. I'm sorry. Yeah. In my head, certificate was like you were the designated entity for it.
No.
And so you were registered.
Okay. The note.
Yeah. Itself. Yeah. No, that's what it is. It's literally just like money, except one, it's single issue
one,
or
one
money.
Shot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very interesting in that way, but this is what it was. It's essentially a way for you. And typically the reason bonds exist is they're not always issued in specific increments. It's usually me, the business says, I'm going to take an X dollar amount and generate a bond with it that I can redeem. Like, I'm giving this to you as an IOU essentially. So mm-hmm. I don't have to give you anything real right now, but then you can hang on to it or give it to someone else. And then
yeah, you could literally use it as money if you want.
Yes. Or at some point, and its value is whoever holds it could at any point come redeem it for something else. And bearer bonds can also be issued for things not in dollar amounts too.
Mm-hmm.
Bearer bonds can be issued as forms of stock, which is interesting. So a business could say this entitles you to 10% of our overall profits from this point, but we don't have to pay it until you give the bond back. So it continues to accrue value, but the company didn't have to give you explicit stock for it. Like, there's a bunch of weird things
right.
going on.
So anyway, they can trade around this royalty ticket, essentially.
Essentially, yeah, but without collecting on it, because you have to trade it to get the value.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't entitle you to it on a regular interval. It just entitles you to that some amount until you redeem it.
Right, so you're incentivized to not redeem it until you really need it.
Exactly. And that's good for the business because now they have value that you are not incentivized to claim.
Right.
But it also incurs a ton of risk. A lot of fraud has been committed by businesses over issuing
mm-hmm.
these bonds and not having the ability to cover them on the hope that they would not all be cashed at once. Side note, this is why economic crashes are a big deal. Because there are perhaps legal ways to do this and stretch yourself too thin. Anyway, not the point. Yep. Back to currency. So, yeah. So, why? Why money? We kind of talked about that a little bit.
Yeah, we did. About the... Yeah, the barter system is great when all you're trading around is animals, maybe land, maybe structures, but...
Things most people have or need. And they're relatively right. limited, yeah.
Yes, but yeah, when you want to start trading in more obscure things, then you need something in between, a medium of exchange, to facilitate that. So yeah, that is why money.
Yes. One last bit about bartering, I guess. Bartering still happens all the time, which we yes. kind of stated. But there's an interesting scenario that I've heard about that people have advocated the bartering system when it comes to healthcare. So most places, healthcare is rather centralized. For example, if you and I needed to receive some form of healthcare, the first place that you might think to go is a hospital which is a business that happens to just employ a bunch of doctors and nurses and facilities that they can all use to do health medical stuff. But in people often will cite the antiquated method of healthcare, which is your local doctor, when there was the local doctor in the tiny town in which you lived. That local doctor would, and there's a problem with healthcare, whereas in you may not ever need that service necessarily, but when you do, it's urgent usually, and you can't, you need it, even if you can't pay for it to live, and if you don't receive it, you can't pay any debt for it. So there's a weird, there's a lot of mixed incentives into getting treatment for things.
Yes.
And in what level of care you might receive. But bartering kind of fits into that system pretty nicely, because it's also very variant. So a good example, this is a example from a family history of mine. I've had a relative before that traded labor for healthcare. Because that particular family member was really good at doing a particular type of labor, but it's not widely necessary. So they don't get paid very much for doing it. However, in specific instances is extremely valuable. So it just so happened to be the case that they were able to trade that service for healthcare because that service is also rare to come by because it's rarely needed, just like healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So there's interesting instances in which if you were able to, and I would say that any prohibitions or inhibitions placed on bartering are awful. I think that bartering should always be a fallback option to using currency, I would say. Because there are circumstances in which you can potentially use bartering to supplement a lack of currency.
Sure.
And I think most people could do that. So anyway, that's just a weird side note about bartering when it comes to money, is that
I think labor trading like that is also very interesting.
Yeah.
That, yeah, like bartering gets cumbersome because now we have all these not obscure but specialized things that we may want or have, and it's hard to find common ground for what people want to trade for. But everybody needs a job done.
Yes.
So, you know, you can often find something like that, you know.
You know, then you bring it up. That brings up another interesting place where this still happens a lot, in crime or in criminal enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal enterprises are highly disincentivized to use fiat currency because fiat currency is often used as an avenue for government intrusion. And also because any valuables you may have that may have been illegally procured, you can't exactly go to the government to get them back.
Mm-hmm.
But labor is always available, and labor can be redeemed at a future time and isn't necessarily regulated the same way. So you might see criminal enterprises provide services to one another in exchange for currency because it's convenient to their needs. You see this a lot in things like protection, or more commonly product logistics. But yeah, everyone needs a job done. And one thing that I would say that criminal enterprises are more capable of doing is readily accepting any job that needs to be done, regardless of its legality.
Yeah.
Or they'll trade to do some illegal work for someone who will just go do menial work that may just be dirty or awful, you know. But that's interesting. So,
yes.
But how, David?
How is money?
How is money?
Everyone asks, what is money? But nobody ever wonders, how is money?
Exactly.
Okay. So I had a couple of things I wanted to go into with this. What I mean by how is money is how does money behave? What is the nature of money? Because although money is in an ideal society made of inanimate objects, and so it doesn't have a will of its own, it does move in predictable patterns, which can sometimes be not anthropomorphized, but you know, you can characterize it as its own behavior. So people often wonder why the rich seem to get richer. And it seems obvious at first thought, well, okay, if you have money, then you can buy more things to make you more money.
Or if you were able to acquire a lot of money initially, why would that skill not all, whatever you did to get money initially, not also be a valuable strategy?
Yes, that's also another thing. Yeah, you did something to get that money. If you keep doing it, you will continue to get more money.
Right.
Right. And so then, yeah, so what I said was the way that this actually normally ends up happening is people who wonder why the rich get richer don't understand the distinction between liabilities and assets. So when you buy something to use or consume it, it is a liability.
Right.
You are losing money to get this thing.
It's depreciable.
Yes.
Or it does depreciate in value.
Right. Where an asset is property that can make you money somehow.
Right.
Be that, you know, like a stock, which entitles you to some of the company's profits from time to time, or is otherwise valuable and may increase in value, or it could be some sort of royalty entitlement, or it could be a literal item that you expect to appreciate in value, or land or a house or something like that.
Which I think begs the question, does something's status as a liability or a asset, is it transient?
Yes, it can be.
Yeah. So like, for example, a very common thing that people often refer to as an asset, whereas more realistically, they're almost always a liability, is like a car or a vehicle.
Yes.
There's the old saying that the moment those tires hit the road off the lot, the car halves in value.
Yeah.
Which is true if you were to sell it back to that same dealership. However, if you manage to keep that car running long enough and it becomes an antique and rare, it might become an asset, because there are people that deal in antique cars that are assets, not liabilities, but they only become that asset with time.
Yes. It also can depend how you're going to use the thing. So if you buy a car that you don't necessarily, let's say you already have a car that you use to get to your day job.
Right.
Like, so you need that to get to your day job. That's fine. If you buy another one, that is now almost certainly a liability, unless, like, if you bought a new car, let's say.
Right.
Because there could be another thing. Like, it could become an asset if you bought a used car for purposes of improving it and then selling it. But if you just buy another car for having another car, that's only losing you money. You're just using it for, you know, maybe it saves you money. Like if you buy a car with a particular type of utility that your other one doesn't, then, you know, it's useful to you in that way, but really it's just costing you money. If you buy several cars for purposes of outfitting a fleet of workers to do things for your business, now it's an asset.
Yep.
Which
is kind of interesting real quick, because the same actual physical car changes states depending on perspective as well. Like,
yes.
For example, the car leaves the manufacturer as an asset because it's something to be sold. And it enters the hands of a dealer, which is using it as an asset because they're going to sell it. Only when it gets into the hands of a consumer that intends to use it does it become a liability for a period of time.
Yeah.
And then, depending on how that user uses it,
it could become an asset again.
It can become an asset again. Yeah, it's the same car. Yeah.
Another common thing, this is one that people often think of as an investment or an asset, but really isn't, a house. The house that you live in.
Yes.
People will think, okay, well, I'm gonna buy this house and put all this money into it because it's an investment and I'll be able to sell it again later. Well, maybe you will, but you will probably degrade the house over the course of using it in some way. And so then you'll have to pay to fix all of those degradations before you'll be able to sell it. And even then, you can't guarantee that the house's value will go up in that time. The housing market might decline, and you might actually lose money over that, over the period that you're paying off the house and living in it.
You won't really know until you sell it.
Right. But a way house can, either that same house or a new house can be an asset, is if you, if you're using it purely as an investment property and renting it out to somebody else. Now there's cash flow. The tenant is paying you on a regular basis to stay in that house. It's making you money. Now, obviously, you're going to have to sink some money back into it to keep all the things maintained. But if you price your rent correctly, that shouldn't matter. You should be able to cover the cost of whatever mortgage payments you might be making on the house, plus whatever maintenance needs to be done. And of course, once the house is paid off, then it's just making money.
I think the reason people most typically look at a house as an asset over a liability, though, is that housing prices over... Okay, it's not just the house price. It's the land price under that house. Typically speaking, land is one of the scarcest resources there is, because it's not necessarily being created. It is, but not at the, not at any,
not at the reasonable, yeah, it's not rate. Keeping up with the rate at which people want it. Yeah.
Right. Also, houses will degrade faster unoccupied most of the time than occupied. Home, and that's, there's an interesting,
yeah, that's an interesting, that. Interesting thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And houses need, it's weird how they almost magically need a person in them to continue to sustain. And is, and even if you don't do anything particularly useful to the house, like you don't even have to, a good example, if you take the same, take two copies of the exact same house in different timelines or whatever, if you leave one vacant and you just put a person in one that they don't do any maintenance to the house, they just live in it, the one that is just lived in will still last longer than the one that is unmaintained. Because your presence just almost holds back nature to the outside from reclaiming the house. It's strange how that works. Even something as simple as running something like an air conditioning unit in the home to keep it at a climate that's good for you also tends to be good for maintaining the house. It keeps the air drier, because, you know, dampness leads to corrosion
and mold.
Yes. But you just running AC to keep yourself comfortable dramatically reduces those things. Critters do not like being in places where you are. They just avoid you.
They're afraid of you. Yeah.
Yeah. So your presence just keeps the house from degrading as fast. And so it's almost just a consequence of your presence and just putting the most minimal amount of effort to keep it happy for you, not for the sake of the house, kind of ends up with it being an asset most of the time. I think that's why it's thought of that way.
Yeah.
Even though if you moved in and you threw ragers every weekend for a year and just totally destroyed the place, then no, it's not an asset, but that's not the typical case, I would say.
Right. So that's liabilities and assets. A thing related to this, why it's important to have assets, because you can keep making money at your day job and that's fine, but inflation is another factor here where it is not worth it pretty much ever to just hold on to money.
Beyond specific instances related only to you in like averting emergency situations.
Exactly. Yeah. It is financially responsible to have an emergency fund because you don't want to be caught without money if something very expensive happens. So you need that, or like if you lose your job, you might want to keep, you know, a few extra months, salary or wages in a savings account that you can use, but this needs to be for a short term. Like if you have like 3 years worth of wages put in a savings account, you have way too much.
Yeah.
You should be able to find a job well within that time. And you would get more out of that money by putting it somewhere else in some sort of investment. But people who don't have as much money they don't have as much left over after having an emergency fund to invest in things like that. And so that's why you see money sort of funnel out to people who already have money. Anything else about why the rich get richer?
I'll say one other thing, and that is, I feel like one thing that gets overlooked a lot as well, the rich get richer because not so much, it's not always about their money directly. Good example, the wealthiest people alive today, and this is probably true for almost all time, they don't actually have that money in a bank account.
Right. I guess I was sort of implying that with the inflation thing. Yeah. Their money doesn't degrade in value because they're not holding on to it as money. They have it tied up in other things that maintain their value either intrinsically or through other forces.
But not just that, but the wealthiest of people. Let's just take, I don't want to use too specific an example, but I'm going to just for the sake of this argument. Jeff Bezos, one of the, at one point, wealthiest man in the world, and a rich man, yes. His wealth comes from the fact that he owns 11% of Amazon, one of the, if not the largest online retailer as of 2021, when we're recording this. He cannot redeem that for, he cannot actually redeem those, he cannot sell it all.
Yes.
And actually get the amount of dollars it's worth.
Yes. Because him wanting to sell it will lower confidence in the stock, right, and it will lose value as he sells it.
Right. And not only that, but say, but then you might ask, well, why not just sell it all at once and cash out right now? Well, to who?
Right.
He's the richest man in the world. No one person can afford to buy all of his stock. And realistically, right.
So he has to put up offers that people can offer back on one at a time. And so, yeah, it can't be done in one transaction.
It can't be done. But what this represents, though, is that there's value in just being able to do what he's, just to be able to facilitate that process. It's influence. That money, and it's not influence as in I can pay people off kind of influence that a lot of people think about, which that's a thing, don't get me wrong. But it's the fact that he can decide the fate of the most successful retail company in existence right now, just with a choice. He's essentially serving, he's holding the vacuum from being a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And upholding that vacuum from being a vacuum just comes with intrinsic value that it attracts more money. It just does. So many other things rely on the fact that he has that much money in that place. It doesn't have to be him. It could be anyone. It could be a group of people. And that's often the case when you look at things like nation states. You know, nation states typically do not hold anywhere near the total amount of value that comes out of their country. It's the people in that country that hold that value. So they're incentivized to keep those people there. And so the rich get richer by faculty of wealth attracts wealth. Wealth generates wealth, not just through the method of assets, but through offshoots of that wealth and facilitating what that wealth can be used for, you know. And in some strange cases, by that wealth not being claimed. Like, I'm sure the board of Amazon would be more than happy to pay Jeff Bezos a enormous salary to keep him from redeeming his already claimed value on the company,
mm-hmm,
because of what it would do to the future of that company. And that's what it is. It's futures, which I'm not necessarily talking about the financial tool and of futures, which that's a whole other thing. We're not going to get into it.
Way off topic. Yeah.
Way off topic. But the rich get richer because of what other people want to happen by them either acting or enacting, just because they have the money they do. They can get wealthier by spending all of their money. Just depending, and they don't even have to buy assets to do this. They can get wealthier by spending all their money on other things just so that other people can benefit. It's just the accumulation at a point gives them influence to be able to attract wealth in other ways. And it makes sense when you think about it in terms of, it's easy for human beings to look at an individual or a small group of individuals and work around them than it is to work around a very unstable large group of people or market instead. they're pillars of the market. And you see this more often happen with big companies instead of the person themselves, but they're just necessary for the functions of society. And as long as society functions and if society prospers and they have a, and this is coming back to your asset analogy, if they're staked in the success of the society, they benefit, you know, and because, and the larger stake they hold, the more wealth they continue to accrue or accumulate. And in addition to being immune to things like inflation, essentially, just by having so high a percentage of their assets, you know, and I've told you, we talked about this before. There's the concept of an honest day's work or an honest pay. What people mean by that is it's wage pay, that you actually did something and made some labor with your own two hands, or you did something directly to make money.
Yes.
That's what people mean when they say honest pay, because that's something that anyone can do. Dishonest pay, which no one ever says that, but that's what's implied by there being honest pay. Then what's dishonest pay? That's money you make that you didn't have to do anything, and not everyone can do that. And it feels unfair, even though you could get to that point yourself, perhaps someday. Or right now, depending on how much money you have, if you just choose to spend it differently.
Sure.
But you can only make so much money with honest pay. You, the individual.
Yeah, you only have so many hours in a day that you can work. And of course, if you spend all of those hours working, you'll eventually kill yourself doing it.
Exactly.
So yeah, eventually you have to get some sort of passive income, or you will hit a cap on how much you can ever earn.
And I think the last thing needs to be said about that is that you're not ripping anyone off to do this.
No.
Other people are voluntarily exchanging for this, for you to own something. Good example, rent. If I buy a house, I cannot force anyone to come in and rent it from me.
No.
No.
You just have a thing that other people want.
Yes.
And they'll pay you to use it.
Exactly. So I don't know. I guess that's my whole bag with that thing is honest pay is a little disingenuous, I think, but I get what's being said, but it's because there's a cap, but there's also a cap on expenditure, really, realistically, for human beings, like reasonable, I would say, expenditure. You as an individual not only are capped in how much you can wealth you can generate for yourself directly, but you're also kind of capped at your expenses. The greatest example is we all relatively consume about the same number of calories a day. You can shape those calories in many different forms and various degrees of value, but there's even the, if you ate the most expensive, like, I don't even know what the most expensive meal of you could ever get is. And I'm not talking like, I could make a milkshake and say, this is $1 million milkshake. And literally it's $1 million because I'm saying it's $1 million. But if we're talking, that's dishonest, right? I think we would say.
Not necessarily. I mean, you could be marketing that toward rich people who have too much money to spend. And so show off to everyone at my establishment by buying this $1 million milkshake. Yeah,
sure. But the justification is not I make the best milkshake in the world and I can I'm claiming
You're selling the spectacle of you just bought $1 million milkshake.
Exactly. Yeah. Beyond that ridiculousness, because there are the best chefs in the world can make some of the most amazing food, and it's expensive, not because it's so good. It's expensive because so many people want it. Yes. Right. But even if you ate meals, all three meals a day from that person every day, that's still not as much money as someone like Jeff Bezos has, you know? Yeah. So there's and that's why, you know, you look at things like him and Elon Musk are getting into space. It's, and he was interviewed about it. Jeff Bezos was. And he said, well, you know, they're asking, like, why are you doing Blue Origin? Like, why are you trying to do space stuff? And he's like, well, it's one of the only things that I can actually spend money on.
Yeah, I was about to go there when you said there's a cap. I'm like, well, there's some really expensive things that you could spend money on these days.
Yeah, but they had to come up with extremely expensive things just right, to have like, something think to like spend money on. Yeah.
Like Bill Gates. I have a lot of money. Why don't we just get rid of malaria?
Yeah.
Just get rid of it.
Yeah, you have to go look
these
for
huge
that.
Huge things that yeah, almost nobody could afford, but when you have that kind of money, you actually could. But yeah.
Right, but to sustain yourself, but those are not things to sustain yourself.
No, these are just extra things you can do now.
Yeah, you could buy the nicest house in the world, the nicest vehicle in the world to get around with, and the nicest meals you would need to get, and every experience to travel or whatever, and you still would not even come close to touching the amount of money that is generated by some of these people. So there, you do kind of reach a point where money just doesn't matter anymore. Like a good example, Bill Gates does not carry a wallet.
Right. Why would he?
Why would he? And that's just weird for us to think about, but he doesn't need to, you know? And so there's like there's weird limits in place there. Like there's soft limits on the amount you can generate and the amount that you can consume in your lifetime on reasonable things, I'll say. I would consider going to space an unreasonable thing, but that's mostly because it's just so rare and ridiculous. But I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but like, because there could be good things that come from that. But even these things are just other business ventures. One of the reasons the rich get richer is because you get to a point where you just can't do anything but buy assets at that point. You can't do anything but...
There's nothing else to spend the money on that isn't just blatantly wasteful.
Exactly.
Right? Like, you could keep buying more and more food, but it's just going to rot before you could ever possibly use it.
Right. So, you just get to the point where you either just end up giving it all away, which a lot of very, very wealthy people do.
Yes.
Giving away most of their money because...
What else are they going to do with it?
Yeah. You either accrue more assets, which gets harder, because if you accrue too many assets, then you'll have no one else to buy assets from. Or no one that'll sell them to you anyway.
Yeah.
So you just give it away. Like, and I think that's one of the reasons the rich just continue to get richer is because they're kind of forced by circumstance. They have more money than they can. They've exceeded their reasonable income and have met their reasonable expenditure to the point where if they just, unless they leave it in a bank, which everyone would complain at them for doing anyway, even though they get complained for going out and actually using that money to get, they have no choice almost to get richer unless they just throw it away. They could burn it all tomorrow. They could just donate all of the money they make. But unless they're donating how they're making that money, they'll get right back to where they were the next cycle, you know? So I think that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos could clean out his bank accounts, all of them. And tomorrow he'd still have a whole bunch of money back.
Right. And he wouldn't move spots at all as far as being the wealthiest man, quote, on the Forbes list, because that's not considering, like, bank account dollars. The person who probably has the most money in their bank account is probably one of the least wealthy people in the world, realistically. Yeah. Which is weird to think about. Yeah. But
someone who has a decent paying job and doesn't know how to invest is who has the most money in their bank account.
Or they invest, but they still have not shifted the slider on, they never turned off their 10% or 20% into their savings account. They just left it. And it's just filling up with money. And banks will hate you if you do that, by the way. Banks get real pissy with you for leaving that much money in savings, which is ironic. It's like, hey, well, and not only that, but I mean, going to a bank is different, I imagine. Like, if I have $1 billion, what bank is going to let me open? How do you facilitate that? How do I go to the bank and say, I would like to put $1 billion in this bank account? They're like, oh, okay. Or you accrue $1 billion in that bank account. The bank's going to have something to say about it. They're like, because it shifts their whole business model because they want to lend that money out. But you have created a gigantic risk because you, a single person,
could just pull out $1 billion
and break the bank, literally. So yeah, like life gets harder for you in a way when you have that much money. Like the society and the systems,
at least dealing with your money becomes more complicated. Anyway.
Yeah, the systems we've constructed to deal with money are built and fit for the vast majority of people who don't have that kind of money. And so when you do, you kind of like, good example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They had to create a company to facilitate the giving away of their money because they could not reasonably do it otherwise.
Yeah,
it's insane. But yeah, anyway, we're going to get walking off topic here a little bit, but yeah. Because we have like one more thing
we do
to talk about. So,
I wanted to talk about the question, is money evil? The money is the root of all evil, so they say. We'll get to my sub bullet point here in a second. We'll say, okay, to answer that question directly, I think we would both agree that money is an amoral thing. It's just a tool like any other tool. You can use it for good and bad.
I agree. And even the saying doesn't infer that money itself is evil.
No.
It's the root of it, which is not the same thing.
Right.
It's what people do, or they're assumed or claimed to do with it. So people are moral beings.
Well, I think the implication, not only what they do with it, but what they will do for it.
Or what other people will do to get it.
That's what I
if they don't have. Well, it's different. Having it and using it in a certain way is one way, but what people will do to it to
for it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry. What they will do with it and what they will do for it. Yeah.
Sorry. You're correct.
So yes. Okay, so there's that. So, yeah. Money can motivate people to do bad things, but so could literally anything. People want things.
Yeah, just like how money can be anything. People, what we're talking about is value, mm-hmm. not money. And I think we've done a good enough job of maybe explaining the difference between the two. But to recap it quickly, value is subjective. You and I place different value on different things. Value is just an assignment. Each of us, I could pick any arbitrary thing in the world, set it on a table, and call in 50 people, and they will all give it a different value if you don't tell them what it costs. In dollars.
Yeah.
But that value is factored off so many different things that are almost unique to each of us. But money being the thing that helps bring value to being something we can... Money is just a language in which we can communicate value to each other. The subjective thing. Money is just an objective medium for subjective value. It gets the bad rap because it's just easy to communicate those things in terms of that. Like, for example, most people that want to become millionaires don't just want to have that much money in their bank account. They have some reason they want to do it. The reason you get upset because you don't have a certain amount of money is not because you are just upset by looking at the number or lack thereof of commas in your bank account. It's the things you want to do with that money, you know. And just having that money, I've heard the claim that, you know, money is evil, and the realistic extension of which is that this person has things that I want, therefore they're evil, essentially. I cannot do something because they have all the monies, and so I can't have as many monies because they have all the monies, because that's how it works, you know? But I think that's where that comes from. It's jealousy. You know, I want what you have. It's covetousness, if you want to use a more religious term.
Sure.
But that's what it is. If anything, I would say that the people who are most likely to say that money is evil are the people who would do evil to get it than the people who have it.
Maybe. This sort of leads into my sub-bullet point then. So the thing that made me add this topic to the list, somebody in a chat room that I am in said last night something along, he had some sort of hypothesis. I don't know if he came up with it on his own, doesn't matter. It is interesting that at least nowadays, lots of rich people are very politically left-leaning, and the hatred of money, if it's not a left-leaning, like, principle.
It's a hallmark, at least.
Or a stereotype, or whatever. Sure. Something like that. It strongly correlates. And so, yeah, so you have a lot of rich people who will essentially say that money is bad, which seems ironic or hypocritical.
Sure.
And so the hypothesis was that it is actually paradoxically in the rich's best interest for keeping their riches to convince people who are not rich to hate money.
Go on.
Because if they think that having money is bad, then they will not seek to do the things to acquire wealth.
Yeah. Or if, say, for example, you do think that money is evil and you don't have any, you won't do anything to stop other people from having it. because you're happy because you've met your own criteria for happiness. You've removed the evil from your life by not having money. Therefore, you can be content. You know.
Yeah, that's another way that somebody could look at it.
That's the way I would look at it, is that if
yeah, be content being poor so that I may live in my castle. Yes.
Exactly. Because I was going to say, the two evils that might come from seeking money is you either want it for yourself or you just want someone else to not have it. But if you feel like the person, but if you want the person to not have it, you feel that way because you hate that person. You hate that person.
Yes.
Whereas if you want it for yourself, you may not hate the person. You just want to compete against that person. Mm-hmm. But both of those things are threatening to the person with money. Making both groups of those people hate, making either person who would hold either opinion, whether they want to compete with you or just hate you, if the person who hates you thinks that your life is suffering because of your money, then they think you're getting what you deserve already and they won't do anything to you. But if you convince the person that would compete against you that money will ruin your life, then they don't want to ruin their life, so they will stop wanting to compete with you. It's either side of that. It's just a tactic to dissuade offense.
Yes.
Competitive offense or malicious offense.
Yep.
No, I mean, I think that's totally possible. I also think that there's a great deal of cognitive dissonance. I think that someone can be convinced that something they do is wrong, but not want to stop doing it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Good example is like an addict. You can, sure. Most addicts will admit that, yeah, the vice that I particularly like, is terrible for me. I know that. Being a person who has a vice, I abuse nicotine and I know that I do it and I know that it's bad for me, but I still don't stop. And there's a chemical reason for that, I understand, but there's also chemical reasons to do that for money as well. Even if it's for security reasons or it gives you that dopamine hit to just look at your bank account, you know, you can get addicted to that, I think.
Sure. Watching the numbers go up.
Sure. So you can, and talk is cheap. You can say all you want about how bad money is, but your actions, I think,
mm-hmm.
reveal your true intentions. Very seldom do you see the wealthy just give up their money and return to poverty or return to middle class, you know? And not only that, but it kind of changes you in a weird way where you just kind of become unable to function without it. You use it as a crutch to supplement a lot of things that the rest of us have to do that you no longer consider possible for yourself to do.
Hmm.
This is often kind of a stereotype given to the heiress or the heir, you know, the person who came into that wealth from a young age that mm-hmm. never had to work for anything. They are far more incapable than even a child at performing any type of manual labor. Like they're actually incapable.
Yes.
They would be worse off than your average person just because of that. And you can get to a certain point where you're so out of habit that that habit becomes nearly impossible to form, you know? But also, it's hard, I think, for people who have been raised in wealth to understand just how good it is, too. It's easy to take something for granted when you didn't earn it. And I think that's why a lot of people have a lot more, they're more likely to look favorably upon the self-made millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
That's romanticized.
Yes.
No one romanticizes being born into wealth necessarily.
No.
Some people wish they were born into wealth because it's easy, but they don't romanticize that image as something that's good. I mean, beyond the selfishness.
Yeah.
But you see that happen, right? Like you see tons of inspirational videos about the guy who was born into abject poverty and became wealthy, and he'll go talk to people who are in abject poverty. It's like, I was one of you, or I am still one of you. I understand what you go through because I have gone through it. And he or she becomes a lot more appealing. However, that degrades with time.
Mm-hmm.
Your memory fades and the experience, and all that, but situations change.
I was going to say that I think the bigger thing is that the environment changes.
Yeah. Like, I think the biggest example of which is, you know, and this is not having anything to do with wealth necessarily, but like what you're able to do with wealth.
Mm-hmm.
There's the meme of, you know, like I have older parents, and my father was able to work to support a family of five, you know. So he doesn't understand necessarily, and he also doesn't use the internet, and he doesn't use, you know, hardly anything, and all of the things he has, he acquired and doesn't have to like pay for now. Like, he doesn't pay a mortgage. He owns his house, so he doesn't know what mortgages cost, you know. But he doesn't understand why you can't just work hard and be able to feed a family and own a house and own a couple of cars just off your back anymore, doing manual labor like he did. Whereas the situation nowadays is that factory workers are people that would do the quote most honest of labor are the people who are in the most poverty most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't, like, the expenses go up. Things are more expensive than they have ever been, and salaries have not kept pace because people are afraid to ask for raises and companies are more hesitant to give them, you know. But I don't know. I don't think that money is evil. I think that most of the people, even especially the wealthy who would say that it is, are hypocrites if they say that and don't give up their wealth. They either that or they like living in evil and they just need to be honest about it. You know, what evil of their own design.
Sure.
But I don't think that there's anything wrong with being wealthy or striving to attain wealth. I am pleased to see that in the culture, at least lately, there is the mindset towards grinding for getting what you want. Although I do think one of the biggest lies that people are told is that just through hard work and determination, you will become successful. When
no,
that's the biggest lie that has kept most people in poverty. You cannot work hard to become wealthy. It's one of the prerequisites. You do have to work, and you do have to work hard if you want to excel faster. But in reality, you have to start converting more of your, you have to start looking for revenue sources outside of just your labor if you want to achieve any kind of wealth by the time, and especially when it comes to retirement. I think that's the most obvious case that that people can relate to. You will just not be able to work someday because you will be too old to do your job, but you will not be so old that you're dying, but you still need to live. So, and most people say, well, I'll just save that money up, or put it in a retirement account. But that's probably the one asset that most people don't realize that they have is their retirement account. It's like, but you can make those for you for always, not just for when you're retired. You know, so anyway.
Yep.
I guess the last bit is of this, you know, we are not financial advisors or experts, you know, to cover ourselves legally. I would say, though, it's probably a really good idea that you either find someone who is that or, you know, pay someone who is good at that. And in general, you know, I think my same old man, always said you had to have five people that you can trust in your life. You have to have a doctor you can trust, a lawyer, an accountant, which in this case you're talking about, and a financial advisor. They are not the same thing.
No.
Nor do they do the same job, but it's good to have both. And then the last one was, I think it was like a pastor or something like that. But okay. Yeah, he's religious, so it's different. But yeah, those are the five people you need to trust outside of your spouse, is what he would always say. It was either a pastor or a contractor. I can't remember. But it was a long time ago when he told me that. But yeah, no. I'm happy ending it by just saying that you need to go. If you're interested in this stuff or this has provoked you to some form of action, talk to somebody about it. There are people out there who make a living helping other people make money. Also, you probably need to look into the word fiduciary. I'm not going to go into what that is, but you might want to look that up.
Yes.
To protect yourself. So. That's all I had to say. I know we're over time, but
yeah, this was mostly just a roundabout way of me wanting to talk about that last question, so or the hypothesis. So
what you don't realize is this has been an hour and a half long PSA into you being smarter with your money.
Yes.
All right, philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.